If you get the chance to visit the beautiful city of Arras, it's always nice to wander around the city centre and enjoy a beer and a sandwich and just watch the world go by whilst thinking about the events. In April of 1917, the Battle of Arras, the battle that the city gives its name to. And then if you jump in a car and head along the D939, one of those straight Roman roads that heads to Cambrai, within a few minutes, you're in the middle of that 1917 battlefield. The busy A1 motorway crosses the road. But just before there, on the right-hand side, there's a memorial. It's a divisional memorial. A memorial to the 12th Eastern Division. The memorial itself is stone, and the top of which, as you would probably expect, there's a Christian cross. And on the base of it, it says, "Grant them, O Lord, eternal rest." And there's also the words that tell us that the memorial is in memory of the officers, warrant officers, NCOs and men of the 12th Eastern Division who fell in the Great War for King and Country. And as you walk round the memorial, each of the plaques at the bottom lists the battle honours for each year. 1915, Loos and the Quarries. 1916, the Hohenzollern Redoubt, the Somme and Ovillers. And in 1917, the Battle of Arras. And it's the Battle of Arras that this week's podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, is all about. Last week in the podcast, we talked about the Canadian success at Vimy Ridge, but perhaps not as well known is the success of British units south of Vimy Ridge, just to the east of the city of Arras itself. And right in the centre of the advance was the 12th Division, and in particular, the 9th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers. One of the objectives of the Battle of Arras was to remove this German salient. Not as profound, not as obvious as the one further north around Ypres, but it was still there all the same. And as was the case with so many of the British advances, the Commonwealth advances during the war, it was almost a diversionary attack from a bigger attack being carried out by the French further south. And this first stage of the Battle of Arras is known as the First Battle of the Scarpe being the river that runs through the battlefield. The opening of the attack that day was at 5:30 a.m. The 12th Division, they stormed into the plains that we visited last week on a battlefield tour. And they captured a number of German field guns. And as we'll see later, hundreds of Germans were taken prisoner. And by 2 o'clock, the division had captured Fuji Chapel, a German strong point where that memorial is now located. And it was a day that was one of remarkable success. As we'll see in another podcast later on, the Battle of Arras was to turn into yet another bloody failure, with the daily casualty rate being higher than it had been on the Somme the previous year. But this day was all about achievement of objectives. But it does come, as we know, at a personal cost. No matter how successful a battle is, there's always casualties, there's always tragedy, there's always families back home with an empty chair at dinner time. So to begin our story, we go to the village of Wilby, near Wellingborough in Northamptonshire, about 10 years ago. And there was a mother and son from Northamptonshire who visited the church cemetery there to pay their respects to a family member that had sadly died shortly before. And whilst they were doing so, they noticed a family grave. And that family grave held the remains of a Mr. and Mrs. Arthur and Ellen Height, who had died in 1938. Arthur had died then, and his wife Ellen in 1952. They'd both died in relatively old age. But it was the details below which really caught their attention. Frederick George Height, killed at the Battle of Arras, the 9th of April 1917, aged 18. And the words in capitals, "Reunited." and it intrigued them. Who was Frederick? What had happened at the Battle of Arras? And why wasn't he buried with his parents? And then they contacted me. This was as long ago as 2019, and they wanted to go and visit the Arras battlefield and find out what had happened to Frederick. They didn't have any details about him at all. So I spent the next few months researching him. They wanted to go on the anniversary of his death. And then, of course, COVID came along. The tour didn't happen. The world stood still. Time moved on. Their lives moved on. And it wasn't until last week that we finally managed to visit those battlefields above the city of Arras. Serian and her son, Matthew, the people that had spotted Frederick's details in that quiet cemetery in rural Northamptonshire. It was to be something that they had wanted to do for so many years. So I thought it would be appropriate to take along my microphone and record what we experienced whilst we went looking for the final resting place of Frederick Hite. He's remembered on the Arras Memorial to the Missing. But would we be able to find a possible grave for him? Let's find out, shall we? Frederick was born on the 4th of June, 1898. And on the 1911 census, he was 12 years old and living with his parents and siblings at the Drill Hall in Plumstead in southeast London. His father was called Arthur. He was a naval pensioner, so the family were allowed to live in the Drill Hall there in southeast London, a drill hall that's no longer there. It was demolished in the 1970s and is now a housing estate. Unfortunately, Frederick's service records, or one of about 60% that had been completely destroyed during the Blitz when a German bomb landed on the building in Kew in London, where the records, the paper records then, of course, were kept. All that I could find was a medal index card, and that tells us that his brother William applied for his medals in 1922, and it also tells us that initially Frederick was serving with the Middlesex Regiment before being transferred at some stage to the Royal Fusiliers. That's all we know. It also tells us that he was awarded the Victory Medal and the British War Medal, but not the 1914-15 Star, and that tells us that he served on the Western Front after the 1st of January 1916. So fast forward the clock now, it could be that he'd served with the Royal Fusiliers on the Somme in 1916, but we don't know because we don't know exactly when he arrived on the Western Front. So we can only say what happened on the last day of his life, serving with the 12th Division, the Royal Fusiliers, were part of the 36th Brigade, and they attacked the German positions literally just a mile or so east of Arras and south of the railway line and the River Scarpe itself. And as we'll see later when I talk to you from the battlefield itself, they weren't in the initial attack, which was carried out at dawn. They were to leapfrog the Royal Sussex boys and the Middlesex boys and then go on up the hill and down into the valley on the other side. 12 of them are remembered on the Arras Memorial, and 6 of them have been identified and are buried in one of those concentration cemeteries at Fuchi Chapel, just a few hundred yards away from where they fell. Perhaps, I said to Serian and Matt, if Fred does have a grave, perhaps he's one of those 578 unidentified bodies buried in Fuchi Chapel Cemetery, just a few yards away from the 12th Division Memorial, which I mentioned earlier. So the plan was to make our way out on the 9th of April. We set off at dawn, just as they did, but we set off from Northampton, made our way down to Folkestone, had a seamless crossing on the Eurotunnel. And within an hour or so, we found ourselves parked up on the site of that communication trench known as Houdan Lane, German communication trench. When we look at the maps, plan of attack, we can clearly see was connecting two strong German trenches. There's now a small Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery there. And that was to be our first stop. So let's see what happens, shall we now, as I talk to you from the battlefield of Arras. Battalion diary says, 0 hour, 5:30 a.m, dawn. General attack was made from south of Arras to north of Vimy Ridge. The brigade attacked with the 11th Middlesex on the right, the 7th Surreys on the left, and the 9th Royal Fusiliers behind the Middlesex. Battalion's objectives were a line of strong points from Hodin Lane to Harburko Trench and Holst Trench. All objectives taken together with about 220 prisoners and two machine guns. So we know that this is like the northern end of where they were, their objectives. So it's across this field here. They're coming over here, and there's a line of German trenches stretching in that direction just on this side of that hill. So it's between here and maybe 500 yards or so in that field. That's where they're aiming to get to. This was their objective. Casualties, it said at that stage, 10 officers killed, 3 wounded, other ranks 117. That's what they knew at the time. This is written the day after. The history of the Royal Fusiliers. So this again was written after the war, but by an officer that was here. He said the weather broke in April. It was cold, and on the 2nd of April, it began to snow. At the end of that day, the snow lay an inch deep in Arras. I mean, it's 21, 22 degrees today. There's not a breath of wind, hardly. We can hear the birds singing, and we can see for miles. Not a cloud in the sky, and it couldn't be more different, could it, to that day. Numerous troops had been moved up to this part of the line and found easy accommodation in the cellars, meaning in Arras. They were dark and damp, but stoves made them feel a little more comfortable. Some of the cellars were very deep, and these accommodated battalion headquarters. To some of the fusiliers, this cellar life proves an amusing episode, and it was not sufficiently prolonged to become irksome. So they had a laugh down there, and they worked down there long enough to get fed up with it. Zero was 5:30 a.m. on the Easter Monday. Wire cutting had begun nearly 3 weeks before. That's wire in their own barbed wire, so they can get through it. And on the 4th of April, the preliminary bombardment started. On the 8th, it was a fine cold day. The shelling seemed to die down. But in the dark of the Monday morning, it began with extraordinary intensity and the troops moved forward. Strange but welcome rumours were heard by those fusiliers left behind in Arras, and the troops of cavalry trotting by seemed to give point to them. So they were thinking that they're going to win this with a cavalry charge. On the Arras battlefront, there are a number of Fusiliers battalions waiting to take part in the struggle. Furthest north of their front was the 8th and 9th battalions of the 12th Division. The 9th is Fred's, isn't it? Just above the Arras to Cambrai Road, which you can see in the distance over there. See where the lorry's going along? That's the main road that bisects the battlefields. The 8th and 9th battalions reached their objectives with small loss, took a considerable number of prisoners. We know they took over 200. On the right, the 9th battalion also gained all objectives, captured 2 machine guns and 220 prisoners. C Company alone captured 150 of these in one dugout. So if you remember, this is like a chalk area. You can see it as we walk around, chalk beneath. Ideal for tunnelling into if you're a defensive sort. And this is what we see on the Somme. So the Germans have got 150 men in one of these deep dugouts, but the dugout, it says, were unhealthy places. One of them, in the 9th Middlesex area, was suddenly blown up by the explosion of a mine, and as a consequence, German dugouts were afterwards forbidden. These positions, the blue line, were at once consolidated. So the Germans would have known the game's up in this dugout, 150 of them. And what's probably happened is that when the Fusiliers have got there, don't forget the first waves have moved on, they see this dugout, they realise there's a load of Germans in there, and they give them a chance to come out. And if they don't come out, they get a Mills bomb, take the pin out and lob it down, and they're all killed. But these guys have come out holding their hands up. They must have known for them the game is up. And then what they mean by consolidated is, once they've taken the blue line across here, they've then turned the trench round, because now they know the Germans are going to counterattack from this direction.
So they want sandbags there, machine gun positions, rifle positions to fight off that counterattack. That's always the German tactic, isn't it? To immediately take the ground back that they've just lost. Now, there was a man called Alf Rizell, Royal Fusiliers. He was one that was here that day and survived to tell us what happened. He said, on Easter Monday, we came out in the dark early morning, very early morning, and we went from the town and we went out and we went straight into the attack. After we passed the front line, I suppose we got about 100 yards in front and the barrage had opened. Beautiful timing. It opened just as we got to the front line, the creeping barrage that we talked about. That was the creeping barrage we were to advance. They lifted their sights 100 yards every 4 minutes. You don't want to get too close to this either, do you? The thing we had to do was not walk into our own barrage. Just before the barrage opened, a lone machine gun opened. But just then the barrage opened, and of course you couldn't hear any machine gun then. We went on and got to our objective with very few casualties. We jumped into the trenches right on top of the Germans, but we had to go on, leaving them for the mopping up. So the men come in afterwards to take them prisoner. An author says that the men of the 12th Division, the Eastern, which is East End, were lucky. They'd been selected to spend 5 days prior to the attack in the dry safety of the tunnels under Arras. And Corporal Tom Bracey of the 9th Fusiliers said, I spent much of the time in the tunnel wearing a waterproof ground sheet around my shoulders because of the water drips. A bloody nuisance that was. And this is what Fred's Illamin there with them. The respective divisional commanders working closely together had decided to attack with their brigades similarly disposed, two in line up front with one to follow through and seize the objective. And they had two tanks because they were anticipating trouble at the railway triangle, which is just over there, it's a junction. Another four tanks were allocated to the 12th Division, two to assist in knocking out the island redoubts, which were in the front line. Down there was several of those redoubts close together, and two to advance up the main road, the Arras to Cambrai road. But those four tanks didn't turn up. They didn't have the tank. They probably broke down. Early days of tank warfare. They didn't have the tank support that day. They were in on their own. This is a Scotsman. That's not in the Royal Fusiliers, but is on the flank on that side, yeah, just over the railway line.
Some Cameronian graves,
right? Yep. So this is Cameron Highlanders. So they're here. We know they're here. And he said when he got to one of the trenches that they'd taken a direct hit from one of the tanks, 6-pounder cannons. He said there was one survivor lying in this stone shelter. This is the Germans talking about. He was about 16 years old. He looked very badly wounded, but I took no chances. I had to make sure he was not out to get me by pretending he was wounded. I went through the motions of pulling a pin from a Mills bomb and I threw it into the shelter with him. If he tried to throw the bomb back at me, I would have shot him, but he didn't. He just went mad and the poor devil frantically tried to wriggle away from the bomb, but I hadn't taken the pin out. I then knew he was badly wounded. Now when I got word that my younger brother had been killed on the Somme, I vowed to do it to the first German I met, even if it was in cold blood, to level up the score. But here was a young lad in desperate need of pity, and the better part of me prevailed. He begged me for water, so I gave him a drink from my precious supply. I told him in French that the stretcher bearers would come. I got some German black bread from the shelter and shared some with one of our young officers who'd been watching this. He promptly told me off for being sympathetic to the young German and said, no more of that, Stuart. But now, in the winter of my life, I'm glad that I had pity on that young lad and I just hope he made it. And that shows the compassion of men,
yeah,
in battle. Eric Baker, serving with the 13th Royal Scots, they'd taken the first line. He said there were dead Germans everywhere, lying down steps and scattered all over the place. We were ordered to tidy the place up, so we collected the bodies together, dug a large rectangular pit about 20 yards from the railway embankment. The burial of 24 Germans was conducted by the CO, medical officer and the padre. When I returned to this spot on a visit to the battlefield in 1979, the outline of the mass grave was still visible. Right. Advancing behind the creeping barrage at 0 hour, 11th Middlesex, 7th Sussex, with the 8th and 9th Royal Fusiliers in support. And the Fusiliers' task was to leave the front line at 7:50, to leapfrog through the ranks of the Sussex and the Middlesex, picking up the moving barrage in front of the black line and push on to the blue line. The German historian of the 51st Regiment later described how the English troops came pouring out of the catacombs of Arras Arras shoulder to shoulder in waves 8 deep. That answers the question you asked me earlier. That's what it looked like to him. It must have been a terrifying sight to the defenders of the first line, who were quickly overcome. He says, only a few groups managed to defend themselves with rifle and hand grenades, but it was soon all over for them. Passing through the lead battalions as they plodded up the slope towards Observation Ridge, which is that ridge there, Observation Ridge, because the Germans in their lines can see all the way back into Arras. The Royal Fusiliers now came under fire from machine gun posts in the island dugouts and began to take casualties. Diving to the ground, little bodies of men started worming their way forward on elbows and knees to get to grips with the enemy machine gunners, who seemed to open up from everywhere as the barrage passed over them. This is because the Germans, a lot of them, had been inside these deep dugouts. So the barrage hadn't touched them. And then as the barrage moves on, they come out of those dugouts, set up their machine, a bit like they did on the Somme, and they start to shoot, maybe into the backs of these soldiers, because they've moved on. Some of the 8th Royal Fusiliers were stuck in front of Hamel Work, but their officer, 2nd Lieutenant Maud, led them on. He was shot through the stomach almost immediately, remembered Tom Collier, who added, I believe he was a brother of Cyril Maud, the actor. Lieutenant Maud died shortly afterwards, having given his revolver and cigarette case to Private Collier, but in an attempt to save the lieutenant, one of the stretcher bearers, the one who conducted the church service the day before, ran over to him and he was shot in the head and killed as well. Slowly, little groups worked away at the machine gun readouts, some managing to outflank them and knock them out from the rear. One young fusilier, Corporal Alf Rezel, who we mentioned earlier, had seen his battalion destroyed by machine guns on the Somme in the previous year, and he respected the machine gunners. He says, as I advanced, I could hear rat-tat-tat, and I thought, this is it now, we're for it. He said his company was held up for half an hour by a single machine gunner. He said he was positioned in a shallow trench and was traversing his gun in a 180 degrees arc. That's what they're taught to do, this interlocking arc of fire. In short rushes, as the traverse passed us by, we gradually formed a semicircle around him until he was within rifle grenade distance. So this is like a hand grenade that they put on the front of the rifle. Inevitably, he and the gun were silenced. He was a brave man. We rushed his position and I jumped in first. I noticed he was an officer and was lying dead on a pile of empty cartridge cases. The machine gun was mounted on a post driven into the floor of the pit, the barrel just above ground level. Hanging on the post was a leather holster containing a lovely Mauser pistol. I got that. Soldiers love souvenirs, didn't they? And I sold it to the quartermaster sergeant for 75 francs. That's a lot of money, isn't it, in those days? That was the beer money for me and for the survivors of our section. Rezel went on to say, this was the most successful attack I took part in. I'd been over the top 5 times, he says. Our casualties were not heavy in comparison, and this was the first time we'd seen a travelling barrage, the creeping barrage, first time he'd seen it. What a brainwave that was. I remember thinking at the time, Corps, we're getting on top of them at last. One by one, the redoubts were overwhelmed and surrounded and overwhelmed by waves of khaki. What I think we should do is take that track between the crops up to the ridge, because then we can see the battlefield from where they began from. Yeah. We know this is as far as they got. This was the end of their objectives, because then they consolidate and then the next lot come in, go through them and move up. But we know that this is the final resting place for many of them, because we've got their graves here to tell us that. Royal Fusiliers, 9th of April. Kirk, here, 2 more here. What you got? Yeah, I said 22. I said 22. Well, which then takes us to the Fuchi Chapel Cemetery, where there are some more Royal Fusiliers, but 500 odd that are unidentified. Can we find some unidentified there that are Royal Fusiliers? And if we can, then they've taken them to Fuchi Chapel after the war, when they perhaps lost their identity, you know, maybe 2-3 years later. That's when we turn detective. I mean, I noticed there was an unknown soldier here somewhere, him. So you could argue, well, maybe that is him. But it's unlikely, because that one is buried in a monk's rifle brigade, hide and light infantry. Shall we walk up to the ridge?
Yeah.
So we're going to walk backwards as far as they're concerned, aren't we?
Yes.
You notice now, as the day goes on, the shadows. And I always think it's the men. The shadows are the men.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we talked about the deep defensive positions, concrete positions. Mm. This is a piece of German concrete.
Wow.
Two pieces of it that a farmer's dug up.
Wow.
Now look, it's called Observation Ridge for a reason. There's Arras.
Oh wow.
See the church in the centre of Arras? There's the new part of Arras over there. Observation Ridge. Remember that German soldier? He talked about seeing the Royal Fusiliers. He didn't know they were Royal Fusiliers, but the British soldiers coming out of the tunnels, the catacombs, and they could see them from up here. 3 years the Germans have been on this ridge, looking down, and you can see if you're a defensive army, I mean, we are right between two German frontline trenches, second line trenches here. See on there, look, there's Hooding Lane. Mm. There's one trench there, there's another trench there. But the front line is right down there, look, at the bottom of the hill. The Hamel work, the Heron work, the Holt work, they are those redoubts that the Germans have got their machine guns in. This is the perfect position. From here we can see the entire battlefield. Linesman tells us that Hooding Lane, or Hoodown Lane, I don't know how you pronounce it, comes along to our right there, see, and then it turns left and then right again, and then it crosses the German front line, which is just as the German front line is just second line rather, mm-hmm. It's just there, second line. First line is down there, so it's that close, it's just where the land drops away,
yeah.
Which means, of course, that we were to follow this to reach the British lines, which are over here in blue, we'd have to walk straight through that warehouse. There is a path I found on the side of it, but that's where they've advanced from. So they've gone through the first line because they've been taken, if you remember, by the Middlesex and the Sussex, I think it was. And then they've come up, they still had to fight because there's some Germans that have been missed, haven't they? They're in the dugouts there. Yeah. They come out and start shooting at them. They've come up here and they've gone on down there, up onto the next ridge. And that's where the Fusiliers have achieved their objectives and held the line. But it's therefore between there and there that Fred has been killed. Stretching maybe 100 yards across there. That was their battalion front.
So a few hundred yards. The first line and first German line and the second.
Yeah, the first German line is just where the field drops away. So it'd be right on the ridge there. That was always their tactics, isn't it? Then their second line is just beyond the cemetery on the reverse slope. So that any soldier, and don't forget therefore, if you're a Royal Fusilier and you're coming over here, and you've got machine guns in the second German line, and maybe in the communication trench, and on the slopes over there, you're in a field of fire, aren't you? But they're moving on quickly. You know, they've gained 3.5 kilometres that day.
So you said it's probable that that first trench would have been pretty sparsely populated.
Defended, yes. Yeah. They've cleaned most of them out. There's a few pockets. We know from the accounts there's a few pockets of Germans that have come out of those redoubts and started firing at them from the rear. That could have killed him, could have been killed up here on this ridge by machine gun fire or killed by artillery fire. Yeah, this is the closest that we're going to get to where he fought and where he died.
So just in summary, what we'd done there was started off at a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, one of the smallest you'll find, and that was named after that communication trench, the German communication trench. And that cemetery is called the Hoodown Lane Cemetery. And there's just 76 graves there, bodies that were recovered from the battlefield immediately after the battle in April 1917. And as many as 20 of them were from the 9th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers. The area was partly in German hands again between March and August of 1918, and we found a couple of Canadian burials dating from August of 1918, and that suggests that it was the Canadians that came through here in the final battle around the Arras area and finally secured the ground before moving on to the Hindenburg line and beyond in that 100-day offensive. that was where we started, that's where we set the scene, and we then walked up onto a ridge overlooking the front lines. On the 9th of April 1917, I did walk the ground 2 or 3 years ago in the opposite direction, following in the actual direction of the 9th Royal Fusiliers on that day. But what I found was that there was industrial units, including that big warehouse that's now situated bang on top of their jumping off positions on that day. So it's difficult to get an idea. But once you get beyond that and up onto the open ground, it proves why it's so important, if you possibly can, visit the battlefield. It's not till you get there, people say this over and over again, it really puts a different perspective when you're actually stood on those ridges or in the valleys, that you get an idea of what those soldiers saw all those years ago from both sides of the wire. You can't do it from books or documentaries or films. You really have to be there. So our next journey took us just 5 minutes away to Fuchi Chapel, Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, which sits very close to that 12th Eastern Division Memorial that I talked about earlier on. The main road that goes between Arras and Cambrai, and at the end of the war, at the armistice, there was just 249 graves here, and they were all in plot number one. When the battlefields were cleared, 834 more bodies were brought in from the April and May 1917 fighting. And there was a number of smaller burial grounds that were closed down and concentrated here. And there's now 1,103 Commonwealth burials and commemorations from the First World War in this cemetery. And most importantly, as far as we're concerned, 578 of those are unidentified men. Some of them, as we'll find out, are partially identified by perhaps a cap badge or other insignia, which tells us which regiment they were fighting with. And the cemetery was designed by probably the most famous architect of them all, Sir Edwin Lutyens, the man that designed the Cenotaph in London and also the Tietvale Memorial. This was his work. It's a fairly unspectacular cemetery. There's no real beauty about it. But obviously it's a very important burial ground as far as we're concerned and as far as those 1,100 men are concerned, whose last resting place it is. So we parked up by the side of that busy road and walked in, and we soon were able to read the cemetery, because within the first few rows we were able to find burials that were marked early April, 9th of April, or around about the 12th, 13th of April. And then at the back of the cemetery, most of the burials were unknown soldiers without any identification whatsoever. But it wasn't long before we found a number of named soldiers from the Royal Fusiliers that had died on the 9th of April. And in amongst them were two that we were very interested in. One had been identified as a Lance Corporal of the Royal Fusiliers that had died on the 9th of April 1917. But that couldn't possibly have been our Fred, because Fred was a sergeant despite being just 18 years old. Perhaps he'd been promoted in the field. We'll never know, of course, without his service records. So that couldn't have been him. But there was another one in between two named soldiers, and his headstone said, "A soldier of the Great War, the Royal Fusiliers," with the Royal Fusiliers cap badge. Above the details, we then got the Christian cross and Kipling's famous words on the base of the headstone, "Known unto God." Could that be Fred? The amount of casualties was under 40 on that day, the amount of men killed, and we'd found at least 30 that had got names on headstones, either in the Houdan Lane Cemetery that we'd visited before. I think there was, as we said earlier, there was 20 there. And there was at least 10 in this cemetery that were named, which means possibly there was a 1 in 10 chance that this was Fred. It's impossible to prove. We'll never know for certain. We can't exhume his body. That wouldn't be allowed. That's not right. But whether it is or not, Serrian and Matthew sort of adopted this headstone. They stood behind the headstone, they touched the headstone, and they thought of Fred. They thought of who he was, of his parents back home, having found out that he died, had no closure, no grave to go and see. And perhaps that's why the family decided, when the parents died, to have his name included on the headstone. Like so many others, his story was never fully complete. At the age of just 18, until Serrian and Matt came along, he'd been forgotten. Apparently the family, I think they'd managed to track down some of the family members, and they weren't particularly interested in knowing about it. But we were, and hopefully we'd given him some kind of identity back by following his story on the Western Front and telling his story again in the podcast today. But that can't be the end of the story, can it? Because our final stop that day was to be at the Arras Memorial to the Missing. I'd been there several times over the years since I discovered his story, but had decided that I didn't want to see his name until I was there with Serrian and Matthew. And that's what we did. There was a bit of a mystery, because in the register, in the bronze cabinet there, it listed Fred as a private in the Royal Fusiliers. Yet the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website shows him to be a sergeant and is listed on the memorial as a sergeant. And we found his name. Serrian and Matt pointed to him. They thought of him. And then they realised this was their first visit. Of course it was their first visit after all these years. But it wasn't to be their last. Far from it. We don't have a photo of Fred. I've scoured all the archives I can think of. I've looked in the local newspapers. There's not a mention of him anywhere. Without a mention, there's no photograph. We can't put a face to the name on the memorial. We can't put a face to the name on the headstone in Wilby Cemetery. We can't leave that alone. So we know, looking at the 1911 census, that Fred, apart from William, who wasn't on the 1911 census because he was serving with the Royal Garrison Artillery abroad, had several other siblings. None of them were old enough to serve in the Great War, so they must have a story to tell as well. They must hopefully have gone on to get married and have their own children, which means that the Hite family must still be around. There must be 100 years on, several more generations, multiple relatives of Fred somewhere around, maybe not in Northamptonshire, maybe further afield. But now I'm going to seek the help of family historians to try and help me track down some of those relatives, in the hope that someone who is a blood relative of Fred is going to be interested. Now, wouldn't it be great in the family archives if they've got a photograph of Fred? A photograph that we can then print off, and that Matthew and Serrian can once again return to the battlefields and take the photograph with them and place it, maybe, at that headstone, a soldier of the Great War, the Royal Fusiliers, and then take it with them, just as they did last week, to the Arras Memorial. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that give us them, and maybe Fred and maybe his parents, the closure that they've never had? Wouldn't that be absolutely wonderful? When I sat down to record the final part of this podcast, I honestly had no idea how I was going to end it. So I didn't write it down. I just sat here looking out into the sunshine in my own garden, and I thought of Fred and Serrian and Matthew and the emotions they went through last week. And I promise you, these words have just somehow entered my head. probably the best way of doing it, isn't it? As we think about those men of the 9th Royal Fusiliers and all the others that went into action in the Battle of Arras that began on the 9th of April 1917. But that wasn't the end of the journey for Serian and Matthew, because despite being emotionally exhausted from their 3-day tour of the battlefields, first thing on Sunday morning they were up and about, and they travelled over to Wilby Cemetery, where their journey began all those years ago. They took a small wooden cross with a poppy on it to the family grave there, the grave that said that when Frederick's parents had died that they'd been reunited. Well, on that wooden cross, Serian wrote these words, always remembered in 2026, Frederick Hite, Wilby to France, now you've come home again. And come home again he had. We will remember him, won't we? So we then travelled south to the number 56 bed and breakfast at La Boisselle on the Somme, our usual billet, where we were welcomed as usual by David and Julie Thompson. And there was three generations of the same family staying there. And one of them was a young 15-year-old called Harry, who was visiting the battlefields for the first time. And I noticed that when we were having a drink in the evening, Harry was scribbling away on a piece of paper. And I asked him what he was doing. He said, after visiting the Devonshire Cemetery at Mametz, he was writing a poem that expressed his thoughts about what he'd experienced during the day. And I asked him whether he'd like to read that poem for the podcast, and he was only too pleased to. And in the poem, he talks about, as the soldiers thought, that God was an Englishman. And in the context of the poem, an Englishman means not just English, but representing all of the Commonwealth countries. But that irony of discovering when they met Germans that the Germans believed in that very same God. Let's hear from Harry himself, shall we? We're at number 56, Bed and Breakfast, in La Boisselle. And whilst we've been staying here this week, there's been a family of five people here, including two teenagers. And they've been going around the battlefields doing what you do, researching and looking at the stories of the fallen and people that went home. And one of them is 15-year-old Harry. And Harry has been moved, haven't you? You've been before, Harry. This is your first visit to the battlefield. You come over with your dad,
yeah,
and your cousin and your uncle and your granddad, is that right?
Yeah.
What were your emotions then the other day? You went into Devonshire Cemetery.
Yeah, I went to the Devonshire Cemetery. There's just the specifics, because you see just the amount of graves just from one regiment.
Mm.
It's, and reading the poem, it's sort of...
Before action, William Hodgson, yeah.
And it's just so moving, really, just all from one regiment and predicting their own deaths.
Yeah, yeah, well, one of them did, yeah, he wrote about it. And then when you got back, when I arrived that night, you'd already been here a night, didn't you, when I got here, and we were chatting, I noticed you were scribbling away on a piece of paper, ignoring us, I asked you what you were doing, and you said you were writing down your thoughts in the form of a poem. So have you given a title to your poem?
Yes, the poem's called God's an Englishman.
Right, God is an Englishman. All right, that's going to be a controversial statement for the lots of people in places like Australia and Canada that listen, and New Zealand that listen to us, and France, of course, where we are. Yeah. So your poem is going to explain why that's the case then. Mm-hmm. Okay, fire away in your own time.
God's an Englishman. In the kingdom of heaven, the saints are all out. Christ in cricket whites, staring down a bowler. And the apostles sing, wave the jack, and smash Jerry's sauerkraut. All the while, tea leaves brew, and a beef shoulder roasts for Sunday afternoon. And God walks to the chippy, despite the dreary climb, bringing back 5,000 fish for Pete, Paul, and the Bish. Jesus and his pals, all in the stands, knowing every rhyme, chanting all that ungodly stuff, while Ma Mary, at home, irons a cuff. God bows to King, and even further to Guinness, and God plays golf on England's pleasant pastures. God's loyalties lie with one realm, ready to shoot at the sight of a Stahlhelm. His love for country, king and flag, never to diminish. You call God a Welshman, he'll turn you east and charge a threepence. You call God a Scotsman, he'll laugh but beat you no delay. You call God an Irishman, he'll stare and it all gets tense. But you call God a German, and all you can do is pray. Yet these claims of love prove empty when English blood soaks the Somme. How can we call God an Englishman when the Germans do the same?
So, the message in that poem is the irony of not just the English, but everybody on the Commonwealth army believing in God. And then, of course, what they find when they meet their German enemy is that the German soldier is just the same as them, believing in the same God. Yeah. Is that how you would define it?
It's sort of because the futility of the war, they'll think, oh, God's on our side. No, God's on our side.
Mm.
And then they sort of realise we probably have been lied to. This war is sort of, we're fighting just so the politicians back at home can say they're stronger than Germany.
Mm. And nothing's changed, because as we sit here, there's, you know, two or three wars going on throughout the world. And it is particularly sad, I always think, particularly sad that we ended up fighting the Germans twice, because they are our cousins. Out of all the European countries, we've probably got more in common with them than any other country. They've been our allies for centuries.
Mm.
So how would you reflect on your trip to the Somme now then?
I think it was just, for lack of a better word, I think it's just perfect how we did it. Mm. Sort of going to each place we went to, it wasn't just we're going there just because, we went there for a reason.
Mm.
And sort of looking at it and realising, especially the craters, that could have been farmland, that could have been covered up.
Mm.
But just over time, people have preserved it and saved it.
Mm.
And I think that's sort of really moving.
Because you've been to the Hawthorne crater and you've been to the Lochnagar crater too,
Just the size of them as well.
And is this going to be the end of the story for you, or are you going to be coming back?
I'm trying to convince my dad to bring me back next year.
Right, I'm sure he will. Yeah. And I'm sure as an adult you'll be coming back with your own family one day. Yeah. And it's so important, because it's without your generation, you know, we won't be here forever.
Mm.
And it needs your generation to pick up and take on these stories. Is there a relative of yours that served in the war that you've been following?
No, we're not sure. We tried to work that out, but every time we asked a family member, they would just give us the answer of, we don't know.
Right, okay, well, we'll have to do some research then, won't we? Brilliant. Well, I think your breakfast is ready, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Let's go and enjoy breakfast. At just 15 years old, Harry spoke with such maturity, and he'd given a lot of thought to what he'd seen and experienced. And of course, he's going to take that back home to Southend-on-Sea. He'll tell his mates, hopefully, and as we said there, it's up to his generation to continue telling the stories of people like Frederick Hite from Wilby. Please don't anyone tell me that the young people of this country and beyond are not interested in history and the Great War, because they are. They just have to be enthused and taught it in the right way. Make it interesting for them, and they will do what we do. So it only remains for me to say thank you very much once again for tuning into the podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. And I think it's only right that we sound the last post in memory of Fred Hite and his comrades who died alongside him at Arras on the 9th of April 1917. Mm-hmm.